Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, this is John Noble. I'm with that Chris Gordon, who's been making me laugh a lot, on Hellblazer Biz, and we're here to have a bit of a chat.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night to all my viewers and listeners. I'm Chris Gordon, and I welcome you once again to Hellblazer Biz, part of the BSPN Podcast Network. This is the show where you get to have your questions answered by your favourite TV and film stars. This episode, I bring to you an actor who I very much admire. I admire all the actors who come on, but this one especially so. His repertoire is immense, with many credits in TV, film, and theatre. He was seen as the despicable Denethor in The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers and The Return of the King, and also the lovable Walter, and then also the not-so-lovable Walternut, in Fringe, through to being in Sleepy Hollow, Elementary, and so, so much more. It is truly my privilege to bring to you Mr. John Noble. Everybody, I am proud and have the honour to have the company of John Noble today. So good afternoon, John, over in Texas.
G'day, Chris, over in Wales. Yes. North Wales.
North Wales, that is correct. Well done. We've already established and have had a good little chuckle.
We've covered the world economy and we've sorted that out.
We have.
We know what to do there.
Exactly.
Only people would listen to us.
If only that were the way of all things, it'd be great.
The way of all things, yep.
Sort the world and their wife out. As you know, thank you.
Well, my wife is actually so sick of Texas that she's gone back to Australia for a while.
Oh, right, okay.
And she said, John, well, let's go back to live in Australia. And I said, well, no, not yet. I'm still busy. So, yeah, it's interesting. As I said, after 40-something years, I guess we'll survive it.
Yeah, I'm sure you will. I might have to go and live in London during the week if I get another job. So yeah, I'll be leaving the family up in North Wales and going to work in London.
Will.
Yeah, possibly. I work in IT, so that's my main job is working in sort of IT, and this is a secondary which I'm working to build up, and I've got TV pitch and stuff. But
what do you do in IT?
Process stuff. Yeah. So it's like process management, you know, managing, writing the processes for people to put changes in for IT or...
Oh, so you're programming?
No, it's more of the process behind... Not the actual programming process, it's the theoretical process of like, when someone phones up, you have to follow this process or, like that. Yeah, it's what I've been doing for a few years. So it's not too bad, yeah. It keeps the bills coming in while I'm working on this.
I bet.
Yeah, because one thing I've found when I'm started this up as well is something when I speak to a lot of actors is the fact that there's a lot of times when you've got to, a lot of people do have the second jobs, especially in acting, just to sort of get by.
I think it's all right. I mean, most actors sometime in their life will have taken other jobs. There's nothing particularly shameful about it.
No,
it's
not at all.
Just what you have to do and. I was a bit lucky in the sense that I found out that I always knew that I was quite good with teaching big crowds, you know, master classes and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I was never intimidated at all by numbers, but I was intimidated by the thought of going in week after week and teaching class. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I then discovered it in a slow period. And discovered that I loved it and I got great results. So that I would say that teaching became, for a long time, almost equal in my love affair with my craft. I still do it whenever I can, not very often these days, but, you know, it's good.
Excellent, excellent. I mean, to be fair, you have a very esteemed career on screen and off screen on the theatre as well.
Yes, thank you.
It goes back a long, you know, it does go back a long way with theatre. I mean, I know theatre is a big love of yours. Do you actually have a preference for which you prefer, screen or theatre?
Well, it's an unusual thing to say, Chris, but yes, I did spend a long time in theatre and then I went back and did a couple of plays in New York in the last couple of years, which I thoroughly enjoyed, both wonderful roles and really well received. So that was good to go back there and find out it all worked, you know. Yeah. And in fact, I think I'm going to do another one at the end of this year. But to be honest, my favourite is most people's unfavourite, which is television. Mm-hmm. Because television is, it's so fast. It's so fast. And there's no one's got time to tell you what to do or direct you per se. Mm-hmm. So you go in there and you sort of, and fly it and make decisions and trust first instincts and all the great things about acting. And I love that, sort of not having to be stopped and pulled back all the time by anybody. So television is great. Film is very slow, very slow.
Okay.
Theatre is interesting. I mean, I had to get used again of the rehearsal period, you know. What do you mean? Usually I would have, you know, a couple of hours to look at this. What do you mean you've got 3 weeks? But as it turned out, I worked with some terrific people and we had a lot of fun. So theatre's all right. It's all right, mate.
Okay, cool. And it's just completely different media. I mean, I started out when I was back in high school. I did drama, and obviously that was where I was originally wanting to go into. I was steered into a more sensible career path. So I did all my drama stuff, and I was going to do Lambda and everything. I mean, so I loved the stage. It was lovely. It's the feeling when you're on stage, I think. I think it's much more intimate. Not that I've had any much. I've had one film I've done last year, so I've not had experience filming, but, you know, it's a much more intimate environment because you're like one with the audience, and it's probably different.
Well, you can be. It depends on your view of it. You see, I think this, when you walk into when you're on stage, you can actually create almost a direct line with everyone in the audience.
Yeah,
and that is an energy. That's a palpable thing you can feel, and you can sense when it's sliding, and that works as a really interesting monitor on which way to go. And yet, a lot of I've heard many, many actors come off at interval times. Oh, it's a terrible audience tonight. Well, no, it's not. The audience is not terrible. It's just different, and we're just, you know, we can't be going, this is crap, but it's not. They're quiet sometimes. But you have this connection, and it's called. Ralph Richardson used to do a thing. He would walk onto, say, London stage, and before he spoke, he would scan the audience surreptitiously all the way up to the gods, you know, the top layer. And so the story went, and everyone thinks, "Oh my God, he saw me. He knows I'm here." Isn't that gorgeous?
Yeah.
So I knew that too. I have to say, you get a slow look around. Not that you can see much, but it's a little trick.
Excellent. That's that. Yeah, it is right. It's, say someone in the audience, you do. You see, when you see actors looking out at you, it does look like you. Oh, you've lost a video there.
They got me. Yeah. And you better pay attention because you might look again.
Exactly.
Or don't.
I've lost your video here.
Yeah, I know. I just saw it, mate. It'll be back on in a second.
No problem. There we go.
Low. This bloody stuff. It chews up the battery, doesn't it, Scott?
It does. Yeah. That's.
I know. I just got a charger there. But anyway, that's by the way.
No problem. I mean, you've also been artistic director for the Atlantic of the Stage Company, over 70 productions there. Did you enjoy being in that artistic director and overacting?
No. I mean, it's funny. I did that, and it was a good company. And I had success as a director too. I really did, you know, quite a lot. But I never really considered myself a particularly good director. Do you know what I mean? I never felt that it was my niche. And I thought that there are, you know, those directors that come in with this great vision and, oh, shit, that frightening.
Yeah.
And so I guess I direct that I direct, mainly like an actor directing actors, and that's not a bad thing. But I never considered myself to be a director, although, as I said, I did a hell of a lot. But that was just circumstances came.
Yeah.
When you're running a small theatre company or involved in a small theatre company, it's all hands on deck for pretty well everything, and which is what I loved most, so much. I loved that community theatre. I still think community theatre is was amazing.
Yeah.
And small theatre stuff, you know, you get your dig in and you're still painting stuff. Because when you go into the union houses, you're not allowed to anymore. I mean, we did a transfer into one of the big houses with one of our plays, and I was out there with the paintbrush or whatever I was doing, and they always said, "John, come here. You can't do that, mate. You can't do that here. It's a union house. Go away." "But what am I going to do?" So it was. Oh, yeah, hang the lights, do the light. Loved it. Community theatre.
Excellent, excellent. What kind of genre of theatre do you prefer? Drama, mute comedy, or...?
It depends on how well it's done.
Yeah.
Comedy's really hard.
Mm.
Really hard to do. And drama can be overindulged to do. And I kind of, therefore, it is, in a sense, try not to think of genres in any aspect. Mm. Or any more than I think of with the performance, whether he's a bad guy or a good guy, whatever he is. People don't know what I do, Chris, is simply go into play with absolute truth that character and how he fits into this story. That's what I do, and it doesn't matter if it's because we're people. People are so funny. We're bloody hilarious. You don't have to try and be funny, you know. You don't have to tell jokes. Just be real and it's now, that's the Walter Bishops of this world, didn't they? Never tried to crack a joke.
No.
They were just observing what people did, and, you know, and so he became funny. And that rule goes through with drama too. Intense drama, there's some extraordinary comic relief. It has to be.
Yeah.
Not because someone said put comic relief in there, just it's the way we are as human beings.
Yeah.
You know, we crack jokes about the most horrible things.
We do.
There's plenty of that going on at present, I know. You know, in your country now, there'll be plenty of people sort of, you know, doing the best they can. And that's how we survive. But there's always a round of sort of macabre jokes after something horrible's happened. And it's just
definitely.
Just survival stuff.
Yeah.
And as long as it's not done by presidents or people in charge, you think, fine, didn't say that, did I?
No, didn't. I didn't hear anything.
No, I did nothing. Yeah. I didn't go. I'll be kicked out of the country now.
I only asked that because I went on Saturday. I don't know. I saw the play That Goes Wrong. I don't know if you've heard of that one.
No.
It's the Mischief Theatre, and they were on tour. It's basically called The Play That Goes Wrong, and they play. They're all players, but they're playing a community. They're playing like they are a community theatre, putting on a serious murder mystery. Yeah. But whatever can go wrong goes wrong, and it's slapstick comedy, and
wonderful.
It's obviously, like you say, it's, you know, to act is hard, but to act comedy is very, very difficult. And I think even my 10-year-old son, my wife, and myself, we couldn't breathe because we were laughing from start to finish. So it was a perfectly done.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Well, they're clever lads. I mean, girls and lads to actually pull that off because the timing is so critical.
Definitely, because there's bits of stage falling and everything, so they had to get it perfect.
Yeah, and then you just get a ping and hit the next bit right on, and it'll ring the house down. If you're 1 second out, it won't, you know.
But exactly.
It's lovely. That, when I talk about that energy you can build off the audience, you punch it out there. And they roared. The crowd roared.
Oh, yes. Definitely. Moving on, you've been in some tremendous productions as well. How does it feel to be an essential, if not despicable, part of the Tolkien universe, for example?
It's still hard for me to grasp how that all happened, and indeed how that thing went on to become massive. I mean, the books are superb, and people have read them, and they're a critical part of British literature. There's no question about that. But then when we went to New Zealand, Peter Jackson was so prepared, and they were staying so accurate to the books. Everything was referred back to the books. So if I had a question, I'd go see Philippa Boyens, the writer, and say this, and she'd be flicked through the books and say, oh, yeah, you're right, absolutely, he does say that there. Mm-hmm. And that was the reference. Cool. And I reckon that that's why that Rings trilogy was such a runaway hit, because people all expected us to, you know, Hollywood it.
Yeah.
And he didn't even go for Hollywood actors. I mean, he just went around the world and found actors that could say the words. That was the truth. Because you hadn't heard of most of us, I can tell you that. You know, there was probably three or four actors that people knew.
Yeah.
In there. and the rest of us were just brought in because we could do the job. Mm. And it was a long, slow process too. Because he literally did search the world. anyway, that was a rare and wonderful time. It was a difficult time because Denethor was such a hard character, particularly in the sense that he was given no introduction in that in the series. In the books, there's more of it. And so he basically appeared as a villain,
yeah.
Sort of a crazy villain. So what I had to do is backtrack like hell, mm-hmm. and research and create a backstory where it wasn't there to bring us to this point in time where we met this man,
yes.
What brought him to this point. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like just this crazy guy walked in off the street. He was and I understood Denethor. I really, by the time I did him, I understood him so well. And why he was like he was, and how he could say the things he says, you know, and understood because of events in his life. It's a terribly sad character, but God Almighty, you know, so lonely. And anyway, that's so. It was a hard one emotionally to play.
Yeah,
to play truthfully, to play truthfully, and not as a cutout, not as a two-dimensional cutout of a villain, because he wasn't. And, you know, they only gave me one redeeming line.
Mm.
One redeeming line.
Okay.
And it was right at the end when he looks at the Faramir. He says, Faramir, my son. And so that was my redeeming line. I was looking forward to that. the line happened with me behind a wall of flame on a burning pit with stuff going on all around. Marry me, my son. What the hell did he say? That was it, mate.
Oh, great.
Marry me, my son. Ah, that was it.
Oh, dear. But yeah, I mean, I was actually, when I was mentioned to some work colleagues who are huge Tolkien fans as well, they're very, very, very much so. They did say, please pass it on, because they thought that you actually epitomised the character from the book perfectly.
That's wonderful. That's really important to me. So thank you, That means I did my job.
Yeah, it's great. Marvelous. No, I've had a few people have said that to me when they knew I was talking to those. They're just like, you know, Denethor was absolutely spot on to what they could imagine, what they picture from the book as a character.
Mm-hmm.
One person did ask whether the chicken was actually very tasty.
Not very nice. Very nice. 14th time through. Yeah, filming, as you know, is all to do with continuity and take after take after take after take. And it was so I was sitting up on that great big scene. What I do with when I've got business or actions, I rehearse very carefully beforehand. So for continuity, so they fit in the same order in the same place and on the same lines.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can't cut the film together. And I was sitting up there, and they put this plate of food in front of me, and I was working my way through it. It's almost like I'm going, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's literally like that choreography. And of course, you acted. So I'm doing this and practicing it. And at one stage, I picked up a tomato or something, and I ate it. It squashed down my face. I didn't think much about that. Peter Jackson came waddling out as fast as he could from behind his bank of 400 monitors. He said, what did you just do then? Can you do that again? Yeah. I said, sure, Peter. He said, can you do it more? And hence the great tomatoes. The crunching and all that stuff. So, yeah, he loved all that. And he wanted more of it. Yeah, so that was just technical, really. It was only because I was going through my paces, as it were.
Excellent. Oh, fantastic. It's good to hear the sort of the background to that scene as well, because it was one of the it was a very vile scene to go through to see just how.
But it's also I think one of the great cinematic scenes.
Definitely.
It's astonishing the way they filmed it and then cut it together, and what they did with the soundtrack is just amazing. It's so powerful.
It is. I mean, it's one of my favourite trilogies of films. Even all of them stand alone, but you know, as a trilogy, it's just outstanding. The cinema, everything in it, the acting, the cinematography was just it was just brilliantly done.
I know, and that darling cinematographer, he died 2 years ago.
Oh, I heard that. That's very sad.
He wasn't an old man, he and Peter were a pair. They were a team. They were such a team. And I've not spoken to Peter since the death of Lisney, but what must have gutted him. Must have been like losing your right arm.
Yeah,
he was the loveliest man too. Anyway, but he wasn't. You know, you might say that some people are passing when they're in their late 70s or 80s, and you say, "Oh, well, fair enough." But he's in his 50s or something. You go, "Oh, come on, too young, mate."
Definitely. Okay, so moving on to some questions from. I've had lots of questions, by the way, because you've got a lot of popularity and fans out there who want to hear. This is a mix of everything from that you've done. So Christopher, who is on Twitter as the Irish on Fire, do you feel like Fringe got its just ending? If not, how would you have ended the show?
Who asked that question?
Christopher, his name is at
Christopher.
Yeah.
You know, I really think it did, and we were so lucky. Because prior to that, you might know this if you've been following stuff. The network would just cut shows off like that midstream, and that was the end of them. What happened? It got cancelled, and that happened with a couple of really good shows. And with Fringe, they said, "Well, we probably wouldn't have given you a full order, but the fans adore this, and so do we. So we're going to give you 13 episodes to wind up the story." Now that was the first time it was done. But I know that it's been done. I was talking to a colleague last night. There's another very popular show that's got the same thing. 13 to tie up the stuff and get out of there.
Yeah.
In terms of the hows and the whys, look, you had to get rid of Walter. There was no room for Walter in the new world. There just wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
In a harsh reality, he probably would have had a relapse and gone back to the mental institution, to be honest with you. I suspect. And there would have been some sort of, it was almost like this dream happened. But so that's Walter. But we'd already set up the family thing and Ella, the little girl. So that had to be honoured. that Peter and Olivia did finally get together, and they did have a beautiful daughter, and that kind of became the main storyline, I think. So they honoured that, and lots of people loved it. There was a beautiful work in those finales. I mean, there was a speech that which people talk about all the time, where I said to Peter Jackson, "You are my very favourite thing," an extraordinary speech that Joel Wyman wrote it, and he rang me months before and said, "Well, I'm working on this monologue for you, mate. It's going to be fantastic, but I'm working on it.
Yeah.
Anyway, it turned up, and there it was. And really, Josh Jackson and I are very, very close as men, but as also as characters.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't rehearsal. What they did is they said, "This is also unusual." They set two cameras up, one over my shoulder, one over his, and we just nailed it in one take. Goodbye, see ya.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
That's pretty cool, Gab. Pretty impressive.
Well, it is, but, you know, it's the sort of thing, we were so ready for it.
Yeah.
And Josh was as good as I've seen Josh work.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we were just ready for it, mate. and it was a beautiful, there's a lot of beautiful moments in there. Lovely moment with Astrid where he calls her Astrid for the first time. And
yeah.
All sorts of heart-wrenching stuff, really. If you were a fan, you'd watch it all.
Yeah, definitely. I was about to say, there was actually a question, which I'm going to scoot to now, regarding Astrid.
Mm-hmm.
It was Nikki Cambridge and Jamie, who is at Lady of Mischief on Twitter. They've both asked, "Can you think of any other names Walter could have called Astrid?"
I've got a T-shirt with the names I did call her on, and it's just covered in them. I don't know. Well, I think we did make up a few, and then they'd put in absolute out of sequence. At one stage, I called her Claire, and that one we slipped past. But Claire's actually her friend, so it was just insane at that point. I don't know. We used to make up. Sometimes we'd have an inspired moment and send it off to the writers, but they were pretty good at coming up with them themselves, like, I tell you. It's a funny little thing to put in there. It's almost like it's one of those things you might try, just, you know, try it out in season one and say, hell, that's good. Let's keep that going. And that's what we did. And there, oh, golly. So funny.
It was like a little bit, yeah, it was a little bit, a tiny bit of comic relief all the way through. So, you know, what are you going to call her now?
Yeah, he would say it and she wouldn't even acknowledge it after all. She just knew and turned. So, let's get on with that job. And just think of Nicole. It's just such a bloody sweetheart, mate. And we had fun.
Excellent. Marcel Fabio is asking, how do you get your life back or change character after playing such a role for many years in Fringe?
Yeah, look, Marcel, it's an interesting question. It's easy to become typecast. Mm-hmm. If you do a popular character, then be very careful because you may not be employed again.
Yeah.
So the essence of it was to come because I'd done so many roles. I wasn't fearful in the sense that wasn't the only thing I could do at all. And I went back to Australia and did some weird. Terrific things down there, little film and some television and a miniseries, and I didn't even think about water, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And then I got a call from Alex Kurtzman, who was one of the executive producers on Fringe, and he had this show called Sleepy Hollow, which I knew about. Mm-hmm. He said, John, will you come across and do it for me, mate? And he explained the character to me, and I said, yes. So the trick with that was to not to play Walter. So, I mean, when I got there, they were dressing a character like Walter, and I said, well, you know, let's not do that. Mm. Then Henry sort of developed his own persona, but it was still kind of in the realm of that eccentric character. But that's quite a natural because that was the same executive producer, and so I lasted a couple of years there. Then I went off to do something completely different in Elementary, which was a dead straight role.
Holmes senior,
which is what I wanted and what my manager wanted, but just do something else, you know.
Yeah.
And since then, I've done a few things this year, which are different again. So
excellent.
Yeah. No.
Well, it's good. It's great. And like you say, it is difficult to be typecast because I think there are some out there who've been in a role so long, and you're right. For someone who's watching it, and you do feel sorry for the actor themselves, because whichever role they're in, people always will see them as that particular character wherever they are, and it's bound to happen. It's not, you know, it's a natural thing, and it's, you know, so yeah, I guess it can be hard for anyone to sort of, who's been.
It's not. Look, and you've got to take it. You take it. I do. I take it as a huge compliment, mate. That, you know, if people, and they do, stop me on the street anywhere in the world and want to talk about, you know, just say that. What a compliment that is, you know. So I don't go, oh, you can't call me that. Of course you can. Call me whatever you like.
And, within reason.
As well, even then, mate, I really am pretty laid back. I don't mind. Whatever. Yeah, call away. They do that. And you get your people from across the road. You're like, Walter! Well, I was working with Josh Jackson. He'd done Dawson's Creek, where he played Pacey for a long time.
Yeah,
and he couldn't escape that. He could not escape it, and yet he'd done so much other stuff. But basically captured the hearts of all those young girls who are now women in their 30s. So they were lining up, Pacey. He had to grit his teeth, and then he put that smile of his on. He was wonderful.
Oh, no, brilliant. That is really good. And I say, it's nice to see someone who's, you know, embraces, like you say, it's a compliment, because you obviously played a character that everyone loved so much.
Huge compliment.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's to carry it on. Cool. Michael Danson is mentioned. You did a 2013 film, short film, called Friend.
Oh, yes.
And he's just asking, was your character intended to be a non-Fringe universe full version of Walter?
No. No, but I think I wore Walter's costume. Oh, Lord. No, the backstory on that was, we were filming in Canada, Vancouver, and my daughter Jess sent me this script. She's a writer, and she said, "Oh, Dad, what do you think of this?" And it was the script of Friend. And I responded, and I said, "Well, what I think is, how do I get to audition for it? And I thought it was terrific, terrific. So then I asked my friends, the people I work with on Fringe, I'm talking about all those hardworking pros and cameramen and everyone else. I said, I've got this coming up. Anyone want to help? All the hands went up. And so we finished up having this on this wet, miserable weekend, having all of these, you know, cameramen and, mm-hmm. and sound guys, and everybody came out to help. It was so beautiful. So beautiful, mate. Yeah. And so in answer to your question, no, it wasn't. I don't know, I was in the middle of doing well. I don't know, why would Walter fall in love with balloons in an alternate universe? There's got to be a better way. Fringe is a very, very smart little film, and and it was a pleasure to do it. So, yeah. Loved it.
Brilliant. I'll have a look out for that one as well. Cool. Gina Bautista, of all the Walter food obsessions, which ones did you enjoy the most?
None of them much, to be honest with you. Oh, my golly. There were times when he would have eccentric sandwiches. And I didn't mind that, but as for red vines and all those things, oh my lord, I didn't like that. But Walter would eat anything. You know, he'd pick up a piece of mould off something and say, taste that, Peter.
Yeah, protein.
He would eat anything, and was always feeding his face, which is consistent, by the way, I mean, with the character development that I did, totally consistent. That sort of obsessive behaviour with food is constant with the behaviour of that character. Yeah, it was all worked out ahead of time. You know, we talk about planning, that's something that works for the character. If it didn't work for the character, see, there would be very, very rare times with the science, for example, and I say to the writers, listen, we can do anything here, provided that it's at least feasible in theoretical physics. If it's feasible, then we'll do it for sure. If it's rubbish, then please. Don't give it, I mean, unless he's stoned off his face. I don't want to do that, because a tenth grader is going to look at that and say, that's rubbish. And we only had to pull that a couple of times on experiments that were just so. Some of them were pretty close to the edge, I have to say. But in terms of the alternate universe and some of that more serious stuff, certainly it was feasible, and now, of course, we know a lot more about it than even then.
Yeah.
But wormholes and all that, I mean, I know that stuff. I read it, and Walter was consistent with it.
Excellent, excellent. It's good to hear the research and stuff to make sure it was. That's another thing that drew everyone to it, was the fact that it was not beyond the... It was beyond the... Beyond the probable, but not the possible.
Yeah, there you go.
No, nice. That's the one. That's the one I was trying to think of.
I like that.
Beyond the probable, but not the possible. Thank you.
Write it down. Save it.
It's a good quote. I've got just Lizette Alcazar and Jill Judd would just like to say, or they didn't have questions, they just want to say, tell you sincerely that you're one of the best actors that they've seen on TV or film. With Lizette saying, rarely does she feel the emotions of an actor's portraying like she does when she watches you on screen.
That's such a wonderful thing to hear, because that's kind of my objective, is to be that raw and truthful, that's what comes across. And so thank you, Lizette, and who else did you say?
That was Lizette and Jill Judd.
Thank you, Lizette and Jill. I really treasure that comment. Thank you.
Okay, brilliant. Mark Longenecker is, did you base Walter on anybody? Because the scatterbrainness really made him feel like he wasn't the only one alive.
I lived when I was at university. I shared a flat with a science student who's crazy, crazy, and we're still friends. He's still crazy, very Walter like, and he's huge amounts of energy, and then his focus would be fierce. And whatever he did with complete passion.
Yeah,
interesting man, but very eccentric. And so I used him as a basis, but also, look, there's sufficient research you can do on, for example, Walter coming out of that hospital. Some of the research I did straight away, so I said, okay, this guy's been in here, he's been subdued on chemicals for quite a long time. what would it have been they used on him, and what would the withdrawals be?
Yeah.
Because that will then predicate how I play the first few episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And how he will gradually change, but I need to know what they were. And so I found out, and you know, found out, well, probably within a month, maybe a bit longer, because he was probably on heavy barbiturates, but, you know, the slow wind out.
Yeah.
I love that stuff, though. It's like it's a detail that is delicious with it. But the audiences do get it, actually. The audiences are very perceptive, I've noticed.
Mm-hmm.
And they very often know more about the stories and the plots than we do, because we're limited to the scenes we're in. And sometimes it's almost embarrassing to go to, you know, these big fan conferences, and you'll be getting questions from the floor, and someone will get up and ask a question and go, oh, I don't know. But it's something that detail stuff, you know, particularly Lord of the Rings, God almighty, they knew so much.
Mm.
And speak to me in Elfish and all this stuff. And they're still rampant, because it was such a rich culture to, you know, with all the wardrobe and the sword fights and the language. So you go to the fan conferences, and the Lord of the Rings people are still there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quite surprised when I go to fan conferences. One would have thought now, after all these years, that certainly Fringe would be top of the pops. What we find is that Fringe and Lord of the Rings are almost equal. Yep. In terms of people that come and buy photographs and want them signed.
Yeah.
Lord of the Rings is still way up there. And that surprised me, because, you know, bear in mind, hell, it was released 13 years ago.
Mm.
You know, it's a long time, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And we made it in 1999. So, yes, anyway, it's still... And I think, you know, what's going to happen is that it's passed to another generation and will continue to do so. And, you know, mothers and fathers will play it to their kids, as my daughter plays certain things to her boys that mm-hmm. she watches as a little girl. So, it'll live for a very long time. I think it's, it's a very... There's two or three films of fantasy genre that are outstanding, but that's certainly probably the best of them, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And it's funny when you say that, it's so popular. I mean, because I go to a comic con here, so well, and I think last November they had, Billy Boyd, Pippin?
Yeah.
And John Rhys-Davies was here last month.
Oh, yeah.
He's another guy who I've admired so much. He's a...
John. He's a very interesting character.
Nice. Very deep Welsh voice.
he's a highly intelligent bloke.
Mm.
And he's very argumentative. he's a goodie. He's a good one.
Yeah, he's very nice, actually, because he saw my son in the chair, and he wasn't doing behind the table photos, but he came running out from behind his table to have a picture. It's lovely, lovely man, lovely man.
Yeah,
cool. But yeah, I mean, you know, Lord of the Rings is very high still at the comic cons that I go to. It's, you know, as I say, 13 years on, and it's still regarded as one of them.
I heard just recently that there's a bloke in Wales that wants to do a con just on Lord of the Rings. And I think he tried last year. And then he's trying again this year. I can't do it, as it turns out. But I wonder that must be down south, I think.
Yeah, it could be.
That'd be risky after all these years. Although I think in Germany they still do a...
They do a ring con, don't they, in Germany? Yeah, that's still very, very popular.
That's still going. That used to be huge on a few of those back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. There's that's still going on. I know there's some people who went last year as well to that. Because Jed Brophy was in The Hobbit as Nori. I think he plays Sharku, one of the war griders. He's frequents them as well.
Oh, he does. He loves them. He loves them. He's always sort of... It was a wonderful opportunity for a lot of players who were perhaps not featured so much, but... They went to those conferences and gave them a lot of confidence and travelled the world. And Jed was one of those. And then he went on to get better roles.
Yeah. Shannara Chronicles he was in as the main protagonist in Shannara.
Yeah, no, he's good. He's good. Lovely man too. I like him a lot.
Yeah, I've had a lot of fun with him. He's a very, very pleasant chap.
Yeah, he is.
And Ryan Gage, as we met as well, he played Alfred in The Hobbit, not the one you're in. but he was great. I'll always forget, never forget, he offered my son sweets at Comic-Con, and my son doesn't like sweets, he doesn't like them, and he refused point-blank to eat them. So he was just like, oh my God.
That's a good story, I like the sound of that stuff.
Ryan just said, you've got it right, kid. It's brilliant. Okay.
Funny. That's good. That's your oldest child, you got one child?
Yeah, one, 10 years old.
Yep.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
One's enough.
Yep. Well, I had three of them, so yeah.
Oh,
okay. Yeah, one's great. One 10-year-old boy.
Yeah, one 10-year-old boy. He's all right. He's apple in my eye. Excellent. Okay, moving on. Patty Feit or Feet. Would you be interested to know, or would you be willing or interested in spin-off of Fringe? Maybe about Walter's journey after he entered the parallel universe in the final episode.
Yeah, it's been discussed. It's been discussed several times.
Mm.
You'd have to be very clever to pull that off, because Walter was very popular, but a lot of it was to do with the relationships, and so his relationship with all of the characters, really,
mm-hmm.
which got deeper and deeper, and the one with his son was magnificent, and he finished up having a wonderful relationship with Olivia and Jessica. I always thought that was the relationships that kept the show going year after year. That's what touched people, and the answer to your question is, well, I mean, good writers would do something, but I think you could. I would certainly look at anything that offered that. It's so complex. Oh my goodness, so complex about who owns it and who owns the character. I know.
Yeah,
that's
legal wranglings everywhere.
Oh my golly. Yes, that's right. So, yes, the answer is yes, I would.
Okay, excellent. I'll just name mention Kevin Tucker also asked the same question on that one.
Well, same answer, Kevin.
Yep.
I could give Kevin a separate answer, and that would confuse people.
Yeah. Alternate universe, yeah. Give a Walter answer and an alternate answer.
Yeah.
Cool. Yadalet Rivera Colon and Regiana Santos. What was your favourite part about playing Walter and Walter Nett?
The character enabled me, the actor, so much freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And basically all of the skill sets that I'd developed over a lifetime, I got to use in some time or other. And that was wonderful and so rare to be able to do that. And I could play. I just played. I felt like it was a lot of it's hard work, but a lot of it just felt like play with playing Walter, because he was so eccentric and so out of left field.
Yeah.
Best scenes, best parts. Mwah. Oh my golly! You see the scene I mentioned with Peter. A lot of stuff with Peter was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I had some gorgeous scenes with Anna and Jessica at different times, but. Best part about playing Walter was the freedom to play. If someone said to me, "Look, you've got one more role left in you, write it, go away and write out who it is,"
mm-hmm.
it would have been that character. That's how much I love playing him.
brilliant. It's a nice thing to hear as well.
Thank you.
Cool. Okay, Simon Barry Brisbois. In 2011, you played the character of Leyland Monroe in Team Bondi's video game L.A. Noire, and you're also the Scarecrow in Batman Arkham Knight. Both games applauded for dramatic storylines, thematics and visuals. What were your memories of working on those two games? What was your opinion? I mean, because that's a very different thing again, isn't it, working, because you're just like, you know, voiceover, voice acting for those types of...
Yeah, the second one's voice acting. The first one was L.A. Noire was very interesting.
Mm.
A friend of mine from Australia owned Team Bondi, and they approached me at one stage and said, "Mate, will you come in and do a test for us? I'll pay you, but just a couple of hours, and we're going to test this technique." Where they wrapped me up in everything skin tight and so forth, and they were doing tests with mini cameras around me and all that sort of stuff. And I thought that was the end of it. And then I was working in America, and I got a call. Could you come back and do a bit more? And I said, "The only chance I've got is Christmas," because
mm-hmm.
I was working. So I went back at Christmas and did a whole series of more of them, then came back, and I was working in Vancouver, and another call came through and said, can you please do the show? I said, mate, I can't. I mean, you're in Australia, I'm here. No, we're going to do it in LA. And it worked out perfectly. And that one was that was the thing where you put the suits on with the
The little balls everywhere. Yeah.
And then we just the gorgeous thing about it was we just then acted it out. And it was a very good cast, actually. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we just acted it out as if we were doing the scene or improvising the scene.
Yeah.
That was what was special about it. But the face recognition, a lot of the technology was new. Mm-hmm. It's a great story. So that was, I thought, was a real groundbreaker and set a standard for stuff that came behind it.
Yeah.
And, very, very special. Well, the second one, well, you know, that franchise, heavens, is huge. It's a huge franchise, the Batman. And Scarecrow is one of those characters people know about. They may not have had the same high opinion news that on some of the others, the Joker and so forth, but it was a great role, and he was the featured player in that game.
Yeah,
the featured villain, but that stuff takes so long to do. You know, it's not just walk into a sound studio and do it. Because you keep coming back as they do rewrites and they come up with new versions and new places that the player can go. It's all got to be done.
Yeah.
So I actually voiced that over a period of probably 18 months, I think, off and on, before we finally... And even then, they were so gorgeous, these people. They wanted to keep changing it, and finally Warner Brothers said to them, stop it! We'd already sort of put off the opening date a little bit. Stop it now! But stop! So they had to stop to release the video. Oh, they were gorgeous. So creative, these guys. Brilliant, you know. And I've got another idea! One of the best parts about that, we went to MCM Comic Con a couple of years ago, and Brian Cooney had brought me across separately, but then they found it. So we did the launch of the Batmobile. They brought the Batmobile over from America, the whole bloody
thing. Oh, cool.
And put it up in the hall, and then photographs of me and the creators. It was fun.
Nice.
Yes. That was a very successful game as well, I believe.
It was, yeah, very highly successful, that one. Highly successful. Mm. I apologise about my lighting, by the way. My light's broke, so that's why I just realised I'm kind of dark.
Dramatic. You look beautiful.
it hides the double chin better.
This light does for me. Hey, what am I doing? I know how to operate a light. There.
Oh, there you go.
The difference, doesn't it?
Nah.
If I have a torch, I can shine on the side of my face. I won't do it. I'll let you can have it. Oh, it's pretty fun. I'll let you have this. My light, mate. I'll just go back to the sunlight streaming through my window.
In Texas, It's cloudy and miserable out by my window. Cool. Evan Velazquez, what was the most challenging scene to film in your career to date?
Oh, God. For different reasons, different things. Mm-hmm. Some of them are just really hard. I'll give you an example, and it's from Lord of the Rings. There's a scene in it where he says to Faramir comes back wounded, and he takes him into the vault, and, you know, no tomb for Denethor and Faramir, and he decides to burn both of them alive, because he said that's the way the king should go down, not like to die like the heathen kings of old, was his expression. And so you got Faramir laying down underneath me, and I'm standing up on top of this pile of wood, very high up. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing I've got to do is take this huge vat of oil and pour it over my head, and of course pour on David Wenham, was underneath me, so he was copping it in the eyes. That was very difficult because we had to get it right first time. Because the changeover and getting that costume and so forth cleared.
Yeah.
Or a second take, even, would have been momentous. So that was kind of, there was pressure, there was a lot of pressure because it was very unstable up there on those pieces of wood. Mm-hmm. I felt that was difficult. That was just physically difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some awfully, awfully difficult lines to have to deliver, like when Faramir says to him, you know, would you rather I had died? And he says, yes, I wish that. And we go, oh, fuck, who said that? Who would say that to this?
Exactly.
But I worked out that you could. And, what else? Most difficult scenes. Sometimes they can be difficult if another actor's having problems and starting to act up a bit because he or she is anxious. That can be difficult because you have to be gracious enough and generous enough to know that it's just a horrible day that someone's having.
Yeah.
They're not doing it to personally upset me, but sometimes it goes on a bit. It doesn't happen that much, but it happens a bit. Difficult scenes. Oh, no, I think... No, I love them all. Even the more dangerous they are in some ways, the more exciting they are. and I get they let me do a little bit of my own stunts, which I love. But they weren't
excellent.
They won't let us do too much because we can't afford to get injured. You know that.
Yeah.
But I love it.
Oh yes.
Just do a fall off something backwards or something, or have a fight. I love all that.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. Hard. Yeah, there was some hard stuff. Like sometimes there were just days that were just hard from beginning to end. Just hard. And I hate the cold. And we filmed in Canada a bit and New York too. So cold. And I hate the cold. So that wasn't great. But what can you do?
I know. Well, when you're an Australian and you're living in Texas out there, you know. I'm pretty sure the cold is something you're not very much used to.
No, I don't like it very much. No, I'm just sitting here in 92 degrees heat now. It's beautiful. I was out at 6:30 this morning in the garden. I tell you, mate, it's a good life. Yeah, but I've got to go back to work, though. So
yeah.
I had fun.
Yeah, excellent. Cool. Regiana Santos, this last couple of questions for you now. You'll be relieved to know. Regiana Santos she knows that you're very interested in science, so she'd also like to know if you have any religion or beliefs that way.
Interesting question. Very provocative question.
Yeah.
No, but I understand, and I appreciate the thought that went into it.
Obviously,
look, okay, I'll answer it as honestly as I can. I was raised as a strict Catholic. Mm-hmm. Of the Irish Catholic belt, you know, and that certainly gave me some very strong and good values, and also some which were off key and wrong, frankly. And they were just changed by the church. You know, we thought it was a mortal sin to do them a week before. Mm. Anyway, I kind of lost track of the truth. The beautiful truth of the Christianity that I knew. And then I sort of searched around a lot. And finally, it's distilled down to this. Institutionalized religion, it seems to me, has corrupted or corrupts. And that's sad. That's very sad.
Yeah.
And we're seeing the fact that, you know, that religion's playing such a large part in politics is anathema to me. Because I come from, like in Britain and Australia, we keep separation of powers. It's a matter of dignity, but not here, my golly. So, organized religion, no. A person's beliefs. Now, I'll tell you something. If you look at, say, the top four or five great religions in the world, they are the core belief system is exactly the same. Exactly the same.
Yeah.
I mean, culturally, it's been picked up and done something different. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and that's a wonderful thing, you know, that the wisdom of a Hindu or someone that read the Quran or Christian or that the wisdom of a Jewish person was the same. And, oh, God, yeah, thank you. Thanks very much. Well, why are we killing each other, you know?
Yeah.
I'm serious.
Yeah, it is. It makes sense.
Killing each other. So as a result of which, and the long way to answer that is that I found out that within, it's not a religion, it's a way of life, called Buddhism, there were belief systems which were consistent with those, but without the stuff that I found uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And so I guess I never really made a decision to become a Buddhist. I don't think I am. But I certainly do practice that, and I certainly people come to my home, and you know, every corner they walk around in a Buddha statue. And they're like, "Are you a Buddhist?" I suppose I must be. It's just the belief systems, but I certainly respect. Ms. Santos may well be a Catholic with a name like that. It's from Portugal, maybe, and you know, the great Catholic Church mm-hmm. which I remember with such affection as a child, such affection.
Yeah.
Anyway, there you go.
Oh, she's Brazilian looking at her profile. So yes, but yeah, so yeah, be the same.
Well, that's same not bad. That's Brazilian, Brazil, Portugal, okay.
Yeah, not far. Portuguese, speak Portuguese, so there.
They do, yes. Exactly. And so, and tell her I'll come there. I actually, people have been saying to me for years, oh, we wanted to come to Brazil. I said, I'll come, just invite me, but I never did.
That was one of the other things she wanted. I did say I'd show her this as well. She did tweet this, but I know we talked about Twitter before, so she wasn't sure if you'd seen it. She'd done a portrait of you. Can you see that? She'd done some.
I acknowledged it.
Yeah.
I acknowledged her for that. No, I did. I sent her a tweet back, which is not. I must have gone on a Twitter just the last couple of nights, and I saw that, and I acknowledged it. So,
She's probably seen it. Says probably since question sent the question in to them. That's she was just. I said I'd show it to you anyway. So.
No, look, it's amazing some of the art that people do and show me. It's really amazing.
Yeah, there's some fantastic artists out there.
Oh my golly! And then you got these people that make miniatures. Came into a conference somewhere or other, and someone came in with a head which was about.
I've seen the photo of it, yeah.
And then the other day, in the mail, I'd been to Switzerland for a conference and didn't think too much about it. And then from Switzerland, from someone, they didn't say who, this beautiful, God, about 8-inch tall statue of me.
Yeah.
I actually should tweet it. It's just beautiful. Really gorgeous. The best look that I've seen of this little statue. And I wish I knew who sent it. Somebody in... Because it had all the Swiss markings on the box.
Right.
I should tweet that, shouldn't I?
Yeah. Yeah, just ask out. I know a company called DID, because I collect the 1/6, which are like the 12-inch figures, movie figures. I know a company called DID. That's where that little head came from. Made ones of you, Josh, and Anna as well. They did a Fringe series, so they did a few there, and they were spectacular. They really were.
I'll be blowed. Yeah, see, we don't have any, as you probably know, we don't get anything out of merchandise, which sort of seems a bit rough in some ways, but I think that case was lost many years ago. So I don't know what goes on until I see them. Someone came up the other day to me, I was in Cincinnati, I think, and they came up with this book with my photo on the front of it, and it's a book, my story. I'd never seen this in my life. Will you sign it, please? Certainly. What the hell does it say in there? So someone has taken the character and built something up around it. Yeah, good on them. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing about fandom is that people look a bit cockeyed at fandom, but it's really, for the most part, a really healthy hobby.
It is definitely. I mean, there's some amazing writers who do fan fiction writing. I know quite a few from different ones, for like Lucifer and Constant. You know, they're brilliant, and you know, they the artwork, like you say, some of the artwork that comes out of them is just stunning. Yeah. It really
amazing.
Is.
They're amazing. They're amazing artists in the broader sense of the word. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
And I go along to some, and I watch all these people. You know, maybe something like Dragon Con, and there's thousands of people that are dressed up, and they just having bloody fun.
Yep.
And then they sort of go around all day in their costumes, and then they go and get changed, and they party all night, and do what goes with partying, and they come in the next day. Hey.
It is. I turned up last year to one of Sloth from the Goonies.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's the only time I've ever dressed up.
Good for you, mate. did you take your son?
I did, yeah. He didn't. What did he go dress? Did he dress up? No, he didn't that time.
Not 10 years old, mate.
Yeah, no. Yeah, exactly. He's got to that age. No, he's like, no, thank you.
No, thanks very much. I'll take my footy with me, and then they'll know that I'm all right.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Cool. Okay, the last question from someone who sent one in is from Jamie at Lady of Mischief. She goes, were you able to keep anything from the set of Lord of the Rings?
Do you know Jamie?
I don't know.
Well, what do you call him, Lady of Mischief?
Oh, sorry, that's a Twitter handle, is Lady of Mischief.
Oh.
Apologies, yeah.
I thought you were saying Jamie, the Lady of Mischief, like you knew her. Personally.
No.
Really. So my mind was going, well, Jamie.
Yeah.
No, Jamie, nothing. Some actors did. But you see, I don't collect anything. I'm not a collector. Mm-hmm. It's not something that I'm uncomfortable with. Here's a true confessions. I'm uncomfortable with accolades of past performances, mm-hmm. because they can actually freeze you in a certain place. And so if you get an award, some people will put up I feel uncomfortable. I feel almost nauseous as if I can't even take that into account.
Yeah.
Because and I always say, but hang on, my best work's ahead of me and I mean it. No, I did it, so I don't keep them. Mm-hmm. And so I haven't got, I'm not sure to think. No. So a lot of that stuff, a lot of my stuff went on with the touring stuff, you know, mm-hmm. So I wouldn't have, and you know, when you're travelling all the time, it's difficult to lug around extra stuff.
Yeah.
So, no, I didn't. Yeah. And if I had done so, I don't know where it would be by now. you know, I'll tell you what I do think is fantastic, and that's that, the Observer's Notebook. Do you ever see that?
No, I've not seen that one.
Oh, it's absolutely brilliant. If you get a chance to look at that, I mean, I think that was stunning. Observer's Notebook. Anyway, it's a substantial publication of the background of making of Fringe, mm-hmm. and all the characters, and beautifully presented. So if anyone is interested in getting a very good piece of, you know, the real history of it.
Yeah.
And there's photos of not only us, but, you know, the other people that are involved in it and their own stories.
Mm-hmm.
Observe it.
I'll have a look for it.
Yeah, so anyway, that was good. What took me down that path? You asked me something. Oh, we're dealing with Lady of Mystery still.
Yeah, no, whether you took anything off Lord of the Rings,
I could be all highfalutin and say I took away a life experience, but I wouldn't do that. I took away a very big paycheck.
excellent. I mean, okay, finally, before I sort of sadly close the interview, you mentioned that you've got other things coming out, which you have. I mean, you know, it's not just Fringe and Lord of the Rings. Obviously, you are a very talented and accomplished actor. So what else can we see you in coming? You're welcome. What else can we be able to see you in coming up, if you're allowed to talk about it?
Do you know, and I think probably people know this, I left Sleepy Eye for season 2. Mm. I wasn't happy with where my character was going, so.
Okay.
And then I went back at the end of season 4 after a conversation with Tom Meissen in London,
mm-hmm.
and wound out that major father-son storyline. That took us through till mid-January. Then I had a couple of months off, which I wanted, and then I went up to Portland, Oregon, to do an episode of a thing called The Librarians.
Yep.
Which is a lot of fun. Yeah. And then I went to, and this is where I'm going to be hard, then I went to Toronto and started to work on a series, and I can't tell you anything about it. So I'm going back to do that, and then I'm going to, then I'm booked to go to Mexico to do a film. Then I'm supposed to go to New York to do a play. So it's sort of starting to look all right. I'd like to get one more series regular. Just that there's something about being a series regular, just the continuity of it, which I enjoyed. I was never bored with it.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll see. If not, doesn't matter. These are good. These are the gigs, and it does free me up to spend more time home. So we'll see, my friend. But as I say, there's so much around, and a number of writers that have said to me, "Mate, I'm creating something great for you." But this is Hollywood, and that's what you get told all the time, you know. So we'll see. I don't know. And people say, why don't you retire? You've got to be kidding. Retire? What? No, I don't retire. This is Friend. You talked about Friend, the little film. Mm. Friend, that was our symbol. And I found this thing. I thought I'd keep it on my desk to remind me of my daughter. There you go. Just thought I'd share that with you. So, Chris, what else do you need to know from me, mate? You've just stopped. I stopped hearing you then. Mate, you've gone...
That's because I put myself on mute there, sorry.
You apologies, sir. You didn't want me to hear.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm about to get rid of this asshole, but just give you another minute. Hi, John.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Is there anything you'd like to say in ending to the fans who are watching and listening, to those who are out there?
Well, I think that a lot of people have the wrong impression of fans. They always think they'll ask me, you must get harassed a lot. And the answer is no. People will speak to me, but it's not harassment. And the only limit on it is, and Penny asked me to do this, he said, look, when we're out to dinner, can you please don't, because people rush up to the table all the time. And I just then got to the stage, I said, look, I'm just having my dinner, but I'll see you outside afterwards.
Yeah.
But no, people have been terrific. And it's very touching that somebody has taken your work and found it that, whatever they found it. It's just very touching. So I like the fans. I love talking at the fan conferences and so forth, just to hear their views. Some of them are very smart. And, and then you get other occasions, and this is almost worth going out on. When we did, when we were doing Fringe, it just kept getting bigger and bigger at Comic-Con at San Diego. And we finished up last couple of years in the big room there, 5,000, I think.
Wow.
And the last time we walked out, the stage was full company, and we walked out on stage, and everyone in the audience held up a piece of paper with a white tulip on it, which is very significant because it was a wonderful, wonderful episode called White Tulip. And it was astonishing.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful symbolic symbol too, but they'd all somehow or other acknowledged us. It was a real tear fest on stage. I think Josh and I were the only two that weren't blubbering. Seriously, the rest of them were having tears all over the place. but it was a great send off from those people.
Yeah.
We were treated so well by our fans, and I think this. I think that what Fringe proved a point is this, that the fans can affect network choices.
Mm-hmm.
And no one really realised that before. And then suddenly they're finding that with social media, they're told exactly what the fans think and they start to listen. That's a great thing. It's great.
Yeah.
That's the great thing about social media is that if you have an opinion, you'll find that you do have a somewhere to say it and find a group of like-minded people.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of fantastic things about social media. I'm not a knocker of it, even though I'm of a generation that does knock it a lot. I think it's amazing the way that it's opened our world up and will continue to open it up so we won't be victims to small-minded demagogues. We'll talk among ourselves, and we won't be conned as easily as we were before.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think.
Brilliant. Excellent. Thank you.
It's all right, mate.
Thank you so much, John. Truly appreciate taking your time to talk with me today and answer everyone's questions. I had an absolutely fantastic time listening to you, and I could talk with you all day. Thank you to all my guests and everyone who sent in questions. I hope you got the answers that you were looking for. This has been Hellblazer Biz with special guest John Noble.